to the new show.
And it looks exactly the same to them. That's what's so funny. Oh, yeah, I'm a little
the
high.
The lighting does look different, so.
Okay, yeah. We're
I almost got a haircut, so.
Nobody cares about your haircut. I'm pretty sure not.
Somebody.
So, welcome, guys. Sunday afternoon, generational change. I got to get used to saying that. Mm. And yeah, and I'm in a new house. I'm Jen.
I'm Peter. And somehow, some way, crazy enough, we have this ESP thing going on.
Oh my God.
We do not generally discuss what t-shirt we're going to wear.
Oh, no, you always tell me what you want to do because he cares. Like, I would just wear whatever I want to wear. He can't do that. We have to, like, be in this.
Yes, that is very true.
Or if I'm wearing the purple, then he can wear the jersey. So that's how you'll always see us. You'll never see us in the same shirt because he won't let that happen.
Smash the like button, share. We are about to bring in Stella Morris, my partner of Julian Assange. And again, the whole ESP thing is all about the fact that I showed up here with a purple shirt on and you naturally showed up with the opposite shirt.
I don't know why.
It's just this yin and yang thing that we have going on. So, of course, John, we do not have a better camera. I think we may just be in a better situation. I don't know. Everything's working out. We look surprisingly clear today.
It's the light. We have this professional light. I have a son who's, I guess you guys are all too young to remember. You don't remember Better Off Dead, but he's like the little brother in Better Off Dead. Like he has, God knows what that kid, he's 15, has going on in his room. Like I'll walk in there and he'll have like three monitors. I mean, he's probably like launching nuclear weapons or something. I have no idea. And one of the pieces of equipment somehow that he had is this professional huge light thing. So that could be it.
Wow, we're getting people from all over the world.
This is exciting.
Here. Yes, it is. So without further ado, you know her as the voice of the most important voice in journalism. Yes, journalism, despite what some people may think. It's been an odyssey of many, many years now, but Julian Assange's extradition trial is going on. And we are hoping like hell that it's going to end in a good result. And who better to speak about it than Stella Morris?
And just for, I'm going to recap for people. I mean, if you don't remember, this was the extradition hearing going on in the UK. And the judge in, or the, I don't know if they call them judges. I think so. Judge in the UK denied the extradition in January based on what would be, like, I think, cruel and unusual conditions of the American penal system. And so this is the appeal that is going on. And so, hi, Stella, it's so nice to meet you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So was that a fair recap of where it is right now?
Yeah, so the U.S. lost its bid for extradition in January and had the hearing that was at the end of October was a U.S. appeal. And it was on very restricted grounds. So basically the grounds that the judge decided on in order to block the extradition were what they call oppression. And you have very limited grounds through which you can actually block extradition because the US and the UK entered into this extradition treaty shortly after 9/11. And it just stripped individuals of their rights and created a very difficult legal environment in which one can fight extradition. But the judge had heard lots of evidence from experts, medical experts, and about the likely conditions that Julian would face, because this is a national security case or defined as such by the US. It's actually about journalism. And ruled that he cannot be extradited. So this was the appeal, and we're waiting for the hearing, the judgment, which we expect within weeks, possibly, and most likely before Christmas.
Okay.
Considering the witness that has basically been exposed as a fraud, I don't see how this is even a trial at this point or why this would even continue. It seems to me that they have no case and yet they're going to try to drag this thing out as long and as far as they possibly can. Where do things stand as far as what case they claim to have as a reason to not only continue pursuing this against Julian, but to even attempt to get him extradited to the US?
Well, the problem is that they don't need a case in order to try to extradite Julian. As part of this treaty, without getting too technical, they don't need to show any prima facie evidence. They just need to say the DOJ wants him. And then there are very few barriers that UK can actually erect to stop that from happening. But they did bar extradition on one of those very restrictive grounds. But the US can continue to appeal and will, you know, basically the US case, the case was never substantive, and it's been falling apart since the summer. So two major developments have happened since then. One is that the US star witness in the latest indictment has come out and said that the indictment is wrong, that it basically misled the UK courts because he retold he was confronted with the allegations that involved him in the indictment, and he said none of that is true. And the problem is that this has misled the UK courts, and the judge has referred to the allegations relating to this so-called star witness on many occasions in her ruling. So the UK courts have been misled by the US prosecutors as to the case. And this was the third indictment that they brought because basically they keep on rebooting the case because they have no case. The initial indictment was just a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act charge under Sessions. And then there was 17 charges more under the Espionage Act under Bill Barr. And then the second superseding indictment came halfway through the extradition hearings in June last year. And it introduced, the only novelty is that it introduced this star witness, all of which, and all of those allegations are false, as this witness himself has said. So the case is literally falling apart. And the second part, second big revelation since the summer came in late September. Yahoo News published a bombshell story in which the three journalists had spoken to over 30 sources, National Security Council members, CIA. Sorry.
It happens.
It happens.
That's live stream for you.
Apologies.
All good.
And basically an incredibly well-sourced investigation, including named sources, very high-level sources, 7,500 words, exposing what was going on during the Pompeo era of the CIA and the fact that Pompeo and the White House discussed at the highest levels plans to assassinate Julian and kidnap him from the embassy and rendition him as part of an enormous war against WikiLeaks. And whereas, you know, Julian wasn't killed in the embassy and he wasn't kidnapped from the embassy, this doesn't mean that those plans weren't attempted to be implemented. And in fact, we know from a criminal case that's going on in Spain, that the people who were working in the embassy that were the agents of the CIA were looking at ways to kill Julian inside the embassy, poisoning him, looking at ways to kidnap, that he could be kidnapped from the embassy by leaving the door open and so have a deniable way of saying, well, we don't know what happened. The door was left open. So it's quite extraordinary. And all this has come out because of whistleblowers and because, you know, insiders that are disgusted with what the US government has been up to in its political persecution against Julian and trying to break him and, you know, interfere with every little aspect of his life. And I don't know if you've seen this, but it's just from this morning. This is a UK paper. It's the Mail on Sunday. It's kind of one of the big papers in
right.
Sunday papers. And there's this story, which just came out, which is just an example of how every little aspect of our lives is interfered with. We've been planning to get married for years and years, and then during the lockdown, you know, it just seemed further away than ever, and we decided that we just wanted to go ahead. And when the lockdown was about to be lifted in May, I wrote to the prison chaplain and I said, what steps do I need to take in order to have a wedding in Belmarsh prison? And then received an initial response, but it didn't go any further. And then in about a month ago, actually exactly a month ago, Julian made a formal request in the prison for the governor to authorize us having a wedding there. And there was no response. And then his lawyer got involved about a week later, tried to schedule the registrar, like the local council administrator that has to receive our notification of intention to marry, and tried to book for the registrar and myself to go in so that we could give notice, which is the first step that you have to take in order to initiate the process. And we booked the 3rd of November, last week, Wednesday. And then on the 2nd in the afternoon, there was a response from the prison that they had referred the matter to the CPS. And the CPS is the Crown Prosecution Service. And this is, especially outrageous because the CPS is the agency that represents the United States in the extradition. So, you know, we have a situation where you have effectively the U.S. deciding whether we can get married or not. It's just so disgusting and outrageous.
And authoritarian. It's very authoritarian.
It's interfering with, you know, with the most. This is something that should be just ours, you know, and it just shows you the kind of how it's all so contaminated. And, you know, these are the U.S. government is responsible for what was going on inside the embassy, the spying on Julian, the spying on his lawyers, recording his legal meetings. His lawyers were also had their notes photographed, their phones opened. His lawyers' offices were broken into in Spain. They were followed. Their homes were photographed. Our 6-month-old baby was targeted for his DNA. My mom was followed. You know, all this was happening when the CIA had, after Pompeo made this outrageous move to rebrand or to recast an independent press organization as what he called a non-state hostile intelligence service. And that basically allowed the CIA to take steps that would otherwise be illegal. It's some kind of internal, a trick the CIA could play in order to avoid oversight from Congress, avoid having the president sign off on what they were doing. We're it's just a pattern of disgusting interference in every single little aspect, from Julian's ability to mount a legal defense to his ability to have a family life.
I wanted to just talk a little bit like more on a personal level in terms of how horrible this is for him mentally, physically. And you had commented that he just does not, that he's not looking good. I know that that why would anybody expect somebody to look good in the circumstance that he's in? But could you just talk a little bit? I mean, to me, I feel like the longer they keep this going, it's like this is trying, they're just trying to kill him. And it's like that the longer they could keep this going, it's like there, it's just, it's heartbreaking. So, I mean, would you talk a little bit about like how he's doing?
Well, I mean, he's really struggling, you know, there's no end date to this. He's been in Belmarsh prison, which is a very harsh prison in the UK, for over 2.5 years. He's not convicted of anything. He's only there. The only reason he's there is because the US has mounted this outrageous, bogus case against him. And, you know, I think part of it is that, honestly, I think there are parts of the US government that don't want this to progress. They don't actually want there to be a court case in the United States that tests, that basically threatens to do away with the First Amendment. I do think there are people in the US government that don't want to see this happen. On the other hand, I think there's some kind of complacency that while Julian remains in prison, that's fine with them, unconvicted. While the issue goes through the UK court system, he's not on US soil, it's kind of not our problem. People are confused. They don't know if Julian's in prison for another reason. They don't know if he's serving some sentence. But he's theoretically an innocent free man who's just being kept in prison because the U.S. refuses to allow him to get bail. We tried to get bail immediately after winning the case on the 4th of January, and the U.S. opposed it. And that's why he's still in prison. And as he remains in prison, you know, his health was bad. Just when he was first arrested, he had spent 7 years inside the Ecuadorian embassy without access to sunlight. There was no outside space. And then he went into Belmarsh prison with, you know, it's a prison. It's by definition terrible for your health. You know, there's a lot of, anyway, there are a lot of studies about how it affects your health. And, you know, for every day that passes, his health deteriorates. And anyone who has been in prison or knows someone who has been in prison knows that if you get sick, if something happens to your health in prison, it can be catastrophic. You don't get the care that you get outside of prison. You don't have access to it. It's beyond your control. And it can have catastrophic consequences. And I am deeply worried about his health, because it's getting worse and worse. And he was in a bad state, when he went in. The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture has said that Julian is subjected to psychological torture, because this is, it's an outrageous case. He's been, you know, confined in one way or another since 2012. And he hasn't been a free man since 2010. He was under house arrest for a year and a half between 2010 and 2012. But his liberty has been progressively limited to such an extent that he's now in a prison cell for the past 2.5 years without being convicted of anything.
And Stella, if you can, and we're speaking with Stella Morris, partner of Julian Assange. I think it's very important for people to understand every action has a reaction. And one of the reasons why we've been so adamant about this particular case is, as we say in the States, the only issue that really needs to unify us Americans is corporate special interests. Julian got in the way of that, and he is paying the price for it. And the same has happened now, because because of the fact that in the corporate media was so successfully able to paint him as this heretic and this evil person that stole the election from Hillary Clinton, what you now have is a circumstance where Steve Donziger is going to federal prison because he exposed trade secrets of big oil in the United States. And everyone agrees that this case is absolutely insane and that he's serving in prison. Well, guess what? Because so many of you were silent about Julian Assange, now Donziger is in prison. And if we don't put our foot down now, these cases are going to get exponentially worse. If you can speak on that and the fact that, you know, there has been so much of this partisan factor in whether or not you stand up for your free speech rights, your constitutional rights, is leading to these exceptionally horrific circumstances as a reaction to what has happened to Julian.
Well, we have to understand that these corporate interests and these security state interests, and they are intertwined. And, you know, big oil, I'm in Glasgow, where there's the COP26. Mm-hmm. And I was just reading up on WikiLeaks publications about the environment. And, you know, there's just such a wealth. The cables, which Julian is indicted over, contain such insight into the COP15, the 2009 Copenhagen negotiations, and the manipulation that was going on there, and how countries were being strong-armed, and how the real interests, you know, they couple negotiating positions to, you know, strategic interests and so on. And just as an example of these interconnected interests, BP, British Petroleum, has on its board the former head of MI6. Now, MI6 is the UK's version of the CIA. Why would you have the ex-head of the CIA on your board for British Petroleum? You need to understand that the interests flow both ways. It's a revolving door for the politicians and the bureaucrats. After they leave office, go and work for these lucrative corporations. But it also is a channel back into the state, into the network of the state, into the network of MI6. MI6 has, you know, environmental or energy, strategic energy, as one of the justifications for one of the things that authorized spying. So just imagine the confluence of interests. And of course, Julian has exposed practically all, if not all, of these interests, of these corporations, of the intelligence services, of the military, and so on. And so there are a lot of people who want to see Julian silenced forever. And what happened with Pompeo was that as soon as Trump got into office, WikiLeaks published a couple of major publications about the CIA. The first one was the CIA infiltrating the French election of 2012. And the second one was what's called Vault 7. And Vault 7 basically, in a nutshell, exposed the illegal surveillance of the CIA, just like the NSA, Snowden had done for the NSA. But the difference between the NSA and the CIA, which WikiLeaks exposed with Vault 7, is that the NSA, at the time of Snowden's revelations in 2013, they didn't even have a PR department, whereas the CIA... Well, you know what the CIA is like. I mean, they've been overthrowing governments since their inception, and assassinating, anyone who comes in their way. Or they have a massive propaganda unit, and not just internal propaganda unit, but also connections within the media. And this is well documented. It's not, it's not some conspiracy theory. And what we saw after that Vault 7 publication and this denomination of WikiLeaks as a non-state hostile intelligence service, which when you break that down, it's like non-state independent. hostile, well, critical, intelligence service, well, press, right? So, okay. And so they came up with this term that they then used to take counterintelligence measures against WikiLeaks, aggressive counterintelligence measures, which included plans to kill and kidnap and rendition Julian. But part of that bigger plan was also a massive propaganda effort. And that propaganda effort involved playing on the divisions that had come out of the 2016 election. So when you look at the CIA, this non-state hostile intelligence service, it's very interesting because they say non-state, right? And the CIA is the agency that is in charge of, you could say that probably its only legitimate raison d'etre is to gather intelligence. And so their primary function is to gather intelligence and, okay, gather intelligence about whether WikiLeaks and Julian are some kind of state agents. But you have it in the term that they adopted because they found that there was no link. That's why it says non-state. There was no link, and they knew that internally, and they even said it publicly. But at the same time, the CIA played on the Russiagate hysteria and planted misinformation, planted false stories until Julian's arrest. They played on these divisions in the U.S. They played on the fear of foreign influence. They played on the serious division that had, and just imagine, it's so irresponsible, the CIA planting a false climate. It wasn't just about, it kind of ripped the social fabric in the U.S. And it's kind of what the CIA does. They do it in Syria, they do it in Iraq, they do it, and then they create this chaos. And then with this, they created it in the U.S. And so people, it was deliberately to undermine Julian's support, to create a political climate that allowed the U.S. to engineer his arrest.
They manufactured consent like they always do. But I just know there are so many people here, myself included, that have been following this and caring about this and wanting this since forever, since house arrest. And
don't play that partisan BS.
No. I have a journalism background. And so that's something that's very important to me. But so there are people here please know our government does not speak for the majority of us, and certainly not regarding this.
Yeah,
not even a little bit. They're like going, they're rogue.
And Stella, as you know, we are a horrifically misinformed and naive nation.
Oh,
most of the time.
I still hear people that believe the Swedish assault case thing.
Yeah, like, but they want to disregard the witness case where the guy was basically assaulting people, but that doesn't get, because
no,
this is the problem. When you are in the corporate duopoly we have in the States, at least in the UK and other places, you have more than two options. But here, it becomes very clear dividing lines. You're either on one side or the other side. And as far as they're concerned, remember back in 2010, the Democrats were all on the side of Assange because he exposed the torture program. But then, of course, he did what he did with exposing what they did to legitimately steal the election from Bernie Sanders in 2016. And they didn't like that. And now the Democrats hate his guts. Right. So again, everything is all about the hyper-partisanship problem that we have.
It's a game to them.
But it's also eradicating our constitutional republic. And people don't realize that. And they don't realize the massive significance of this case and why it must be thrown out. So as final thoughts, Stella, what is it that anybody can do to help? At this point, obviously, we have the phone number, guys.
That's, the most I can is just keep flooding their messages. Keep them busy dealing with that nonsense. 100%. I mean, I don't, other than that, is there anything that regular people can do to support Julian?
Well, yes, do call your representatives. It's important that they know that that you care, that this is an important case and that you're not ignorant about it. Also spread the message to your networks. You know, that is so, that is the most powerful thing we can do. I mean, I'm in Glasgow and it's so refreshing to see people physically in the same place, able to speak to each other, because we're, you know, we use platforms to communicate with each other, but we're being interfered with. We're not speaking to, you know, into an open square. We don't even know who we're speaking to and which walls are there. And, you know, they might be four walls and you wouldn't even know about it. So yes, do speak to your family, friends, and network. Do things like initiatives within your organizations, your unions. If you have, I don't know, a small cafe, get signatures to send to the representatives. Get, you know, follow the case. Follow me.
What is the best way for people to follow you?
And yeah, and you know, this is, I really feel that this is it's a snowball now. I think that there will be more whistleblowers. This case is just so enormous and so outrageous that it's just a matter of time before everyone realizes what's been going on here. We have all the major free speech and civil rights organizations are on site. And, you know, if you write to your representatives, include their letter. Say, why are you not siding with the ACLU? Why are you not siding with Amnesty International? This is about the First Amendment. So, you know, like, use what we have on site already as pressure to get others on site. And donate. You can donate. Follow my on my Twitter. You have a link to a pinned tweet with a link to the extradition legal expenses. The U.S. gets right. Its expenses paid by UK taxpayers, but we have to raise our own. So if you can help that way, it's most welcome. And if you want to donate some other way, just DM me on Twitter.
Stella, thank you for your courage.
Thank
best
you
to
so
you and
much.
Family, and obviously send our best to Julian. We will keep this in the conversation as frequently as we can. Guys, Stella Morris won at Twitter. Check out, follow up for updates, and obviously we send our best and we'll definitely.
Thank you, Stella.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. You know, it is unfortunate
she
that.
She was lovely.
No, she is. And again, this is a, you know, it's a case that is not going to go away, and we are in a situation.
I think I've been harping on this for seriously 12 years.
Yeah, well, again, you're going to be directly associated with it, so that's, but to your credit, because you actually have principles, which a lot of people in politics don't have. And we're seeing that right now, kind of like with the infrastructure bill. We could talk about a lot of that wonderful stuff with our next lovely guest.
No, but I would like to point out how international we are today. Yeah. I would like to point out how international we are, because
hey, we love everybody coming in from the UK and all parts of Europe.
Okay, I'm just saying, yeah. So Stella was in Glasgow, and now we're even going further. Although, wait, for all I know, Rania will come on and be like, no, I'm here in the States visiting. I'm right here. But no, Rania Kallik. Rania Kallik is an author, a journalist. She's amazing. She is the best person I know to comment on what's going on in the Middle East. And she's really
fun. As well
fun.
As this ridiculous climate summit that's going on right now. You know, summit.
So, and she is in, she lives in Lebanon. So we're going even further than Scotland today. I feel like we're having like an around the world today.
She is a contributor to Breakthrough News, an exceptional.
And she has her show called Dispatches, which is really good. I've watched that, but I think that's on the Breakthrough News channel. We'll find out.
Rania Kallik, welcome back.
Hey guys, it's so good to be on with you. And thank you for that lovely introduction. Yeah, so my show is Dispatches, Rania Kallik Dispatches on Breakthrough News.
See,
thank you for saying that. And you're right, I am in Beirut. I am not in the States right now. In fact, you just missed it. Had you had me on like 10 minutes earlier, you would have seen the lights go out. Because that happens often here, but then they came back on.
So what do you do? How do you manage to run your show like that?
Well, so I'm lucky. I mean, I live in a building that has a generator. So Lebanon's experiencing this economic collapse right now. That's completely like destroyed the state electricity in sector. So we get about between 2 to 4 hours of state electricity a day. And then for the rest of the day, you're just on your own. So people rely on diesel fueled generators, either neighborhood generators or generators in their homes, or like in the building I live in. So the generator kicks in when the electricity goes out, but then the generator, I mean, generators aren't supposed to work 24 hours a day or they'll break down. And they use a lot of fuel, and fuel got so expensive here. So actually I only have like 14 to 15 hours of electricity all day. And I'm lucky. There's people who are like across Lebanon who are getting only the state electricity for 2 to 4 hours a day. So you can imagine what that means for like the food in your fridge.
I can't picture really summertime. Summertime in Lebanon without air conditioning just sounds like death. Like that just sounds
it's horrible.
Bad.
It's horrible. It's like so humid and hot in Beirut. Yeah. And it's like actually in Florida, you like experience that level of humidity. Like humidity makes the heat unbearable.
I can't live here without AC. There's no way. If we lose our AC, we check into a hotel until it's fixed. Like it's not good.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting though, because like I'm here and I'm experiencing at least part of the repercussions of really like this kind of economic war on Lebanon. And this is what a lot of countries experience. I mean, Lebanon, it's more indirectly kind of like under this sort of siege. It's not really a siege. It's like an indirect kind of siege to really bring the country to its knees. But other countries like Venezuela or Syria or Cuba that are dealing with US sanctions that are just strangling their economies, they deal with these same kinds of fuel shortages that lead to these like snowballing issues that you have to deal with as an average person, where you don't have full electricity for the day. And it causes this like domino effect. I mean, you really don't realize like these people that are sitting in the comfort of their air conditioned boardrooms in Washington, D.C. and like on Wall Street, who are coming up with these monstrous, really murderous policies to really deny average people in these adversary countries access to like the things that we all take for granted in the US, you know, like gasoline to put in your car, or you really don't realize how much you rely on fossil fuels until they become like such like a rare commodity. I mean, the level, you know, every light you turn on to every product that you purchase at the grocery store, whether it's milk or yogurt or bread, all of that relies on fuel. It relies on a truck to get it there. It relies on fuel for like the agriculture sector to grow it, to make it, to feed livestock. Like all of these things go back to fuel. And when that breaks down, the entire country breaks down. And that's what I've watched happen here. So it really is like a testament to the people who live in these countries that they're able to still get through the day based on decisions made by people wearing suits who never have to deal with, you know, not having electricity.
Rania, it's perfect transition to what's going on at COP26 summit right now. Obviously, this is somewhat of a joke because they're not taking this nearly as seriously as they need to. The need to move to alternative energy so that a lot of the countries that are underdeveloped right now do not have to rely on fossil fuels. But we all know that that's part of the plan. So if you can speak to what's actually going on right now and, you know, the fact that the countries that really need to be participating are not participating. So it's kind of a moot point that they're even doing this.
You know, it's amazing because the entire global north is like going to this conference and kind of like saying all these really empty pledges and just like phrases about how like we're, and they're like throwing a coin in the air and making a wish, you know, for the world to be better. And you have all these, the heads of all these multinational corporations like doing this PR for themselves where they're coming together and saying, we're going to help save the climate. When, you know, the entire narrative about climate change that we're getting even is now like it took until 2021, but the majority of the media has accepted that climate change is real. Humans are causing it and there's going to be a lot of problems as a result of it and we need to mitigate it. But at the end of the day, we're still not hearing about the why of climate change. Like, why is this happening? And the root issue this goes to is our economic model. Like, the capitalism is the problem. That is why we have ongoing, you know, fossil fuel extraction. Is because of capitalism, endless consumption, because of capitalism on a finite planet. And we're still not talking about it because the people controlling the narrative are like the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN and all the countries of the global north that rely on this economic model to dominate the world. And the people in the global south, there are like robust movements, climate justice movements, that at the heart of them are, you know, economic equality and are anti-imperialism. And we're not seeing any of that in the way the media is covering this issue. And they never covered this issue that way. Those people are completely ignored. You know, I live in a part of the world that is definitely impacted by climate change. I mean, I remember visiting Lebanon when I was a kid, and then based on now, even in the mountains where it's much cooler, it's really hot. Like there's a difference. It's noticeable. And there's going to be parts of the Middle East that are going to be, I mean, there's kind of parts of the Middle East that are unlivable today. Like, I don't know how people live in the Gulf states where it's like 120 degrees, but other parts of the Middle East where like you need land to grow things, those are going to become more desert and people are going to have problems with accessing food. And this is also a region of the world that's been destroyed ecologically already by endless US warfare. And none of that's discussed. None of that's talked about. And so these voices, these people from the global South, from not just Lebanon and, you know, not just the broader Middle East, but people from Latin America, people in Africa, people in Asia, in Southeast Asia, they're being left out of the conversation. And, you know, they're the ones who are dealing with the worst impacts of climate change. They're the ones whose resources have been extracted for the purpose of consumption in the global North. And there's this huge climate debt, a word that you never hear about. There's like, I think there's something like, it's estimated like over $400 trillion in climate debt is owed to the global South by the global North. And that's a number that's never talked about and never discussed because the people controlling the conversation are the people that control everything else in the world. And I just want to say one last thing, you know, climate change isn't an issue that I can like talk about the ins and outs of because it's not really an issue that I'm like, you know, I don't have any expertise in it, but I will recommend someone who I don't think gets recommended enough on the left, especially is Max Eyal. He is probably one of the best people to read. He has a book out recently called A People's Green New Deal. And it's the title really doesn't do it justice. Yeah. The title doesn't really do it justice, though, because it really lays out what needs to happen for us to actually effectively in a leftist way that will do something to deal with this crisis and why the, you know, the responses that we're hearing, not just from leaders around the world, but even from the people at the forefront of the environmental movement, which has largely, unfortunately, been co-opted by like billionaires and their foundations. Right. Which is why you never hear them talk about the economic factor of climate change.
No, but what's funny is when you were talking about, it almost sounded like reparations from the global North to the global South, right? And I'm sitting here thinking, we can't even have a discussion here on reparations for descendants of American slaves. So the idea that the whole global North would somehow compensate the global South, and the other main issue that you brought up that I want to talk about is the capitalism aspect, because that is so skewing our perception of everything to the point where, like, when you talk about places like Venezuela, where why we hate them is because they were not wanting to have a capitalist model for their natural resources, right? So that was this idea of we all share in the riches of our country and our state, which is, you know, we can't talk like that here because that's like the crazy, you know, socialist talk. And so like when we look at it, that dictates our narrative on Venezuela. And it all goes back to really their economic model didn't suit our capitalistic ways. And that is the whole problem. And that really goes to the problem that we have with all of those countries, isn't it? I mean, ultimately that they're not just giving us what we want.
Right. Like every country in the world is supposed to play a role in this kind of imperial global order that's existed since after World War II, since the US became the, you know, dominant imperial hegemon in the world. And even more so after 1990, right, when the US became the sole superpower, is every country has its role to play. And their role is to be subservient to US, well, to really to like Western capital at the end of the day, based inside the US. And any country that diverges from that path, even slightly, tries to forge an independent path for itself is attacked by this US war machine that upholds this American imperial order. And for Latin America, you know, that's why we attack Venezuela. And that's why we're trying to overthrow their government, because Hugo Chavez came into power and instituted a socialist platform where he nationalized the resources so North American companies could no longer profit and the wealth from their own natural resources were shared and used to actually feed people and give them healthcare and teach them to read. It's why Cuba, since 1959, has been relentlessly attacked and under siege by America till this day, because Cuba refuses to submit to America and has its own system and own model. It's why right now there's elections today in Nicaragua. Democratic elections. You can say what you want about Nicaragua's leadership. You don't have to like it, but you're not Nicaraguan. But apparently the Americans and the Europeans think it's up to them to decide who gets to rule Nicaragua. And the person who's in charge right now, the party that's in charge right now, the Sandinistas, are a leftist party. And that's unacceptable. So even before the elections took place, days ago, the Americans came out and said, we refuse to accept the results. Even before the results came out, the U.S. is already saying it's fraudulent. They're unacceptable. Even as like their allies in Latin America, these neoliberal hellholes like Honduras and Colombia, where the government just routinely kills environmental activists, like routinely happens regularly by these paramilitaries in Colombia that are connected to the government, kill human rights and environmental activists every single day. Are killed by this government. The U.S. doesn't say a word about democracy or autocracy because these countries are client states of America and they serve American empire. The same goes for the Middle East. And so at the end of the day, it does come back to upholding capitalism. I mean, imperialism is just a stage of capitalism on a global scale. It's meant to keep everyone in their place, every country in their place. And if anybody, again, like diverges from that, that's why Iran is attacked. Iran is attacked because it wants to forge a path independent of American interests. And that is unacceptable. The same goes for Syria. The same goes for even Lebanon now. Lebanon is home to Hezbollah, which is one of the strongest, armed groups in the region that, you know, really is like a thorn in the side of American imperialism is one of the only forces that was ever able to push Israel out of occupied land that Israel occupied, the only force in the region that's been able to do that. And as a result, Lebanon is being like squeezed. I mean, that's just how it goes around the world. And it all connects back to the issue of climate change. Like it really does, because I think we're going to start to see something like in the near future where I think we're going to start seeing the issue of climate change used to force intervention. Like, you know how we've been living in the era of like humanitarian intervention?
Right, right.
I think in the future, we're going to see interventions. Like you kind of saw this with Bolivia in 2018 with the US backed coup in Bolivia.
Oh, yeah.
Where they used the issue of like, it was like environmentalists, US funded environmentalists were at the forefront of accusing Evo Morales of like ecocide. To try to like get international support for we have to depose of this person. So, I mean, it's really interesting how it comes full circle.
Yeah, no, ecocide, but yet they have no problem with Steve Donziger, like, you know, house arresting right, and incarcerating right. Steve Donziger.
Speaking with yeah. Ronnie Dowd right. at Breakthrough News, I really think it's important that we address what is now going to be the next phase of the military-industrial complex in the United States. You can already see it. You can't pull out of Afghanistan and not start something somewhere else.
We got to have them all out there.
Are we going back to 2012? Looks like they're trying to get Biden to acquiesce to putting troops on the ground in the Ukraine.
Well, I don't know, actually. Like, I don't think he'll do it only because the U.S. is so hyper-focused now on China. Like, they've even opened this new unit at the CIA, all just devoted to China. Everything, even in Biden's, if you listen to his initial speech about the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan before it actually took place, he specifically cited the U.S. pivot to China. He said, like, we're not focused on this part of the world anymore. Like, our biggest rivalry now, we need to be focused on China. So I mean, Russia also plays into this. Of course, the U.S. has had
a lot of rivalries. Why can't right. we, just, like, why do these need to be rivals? I don't understand.
I'll tell you why. Because America's an empire. And all empires, like, you cannot, it's like a mafia. You can't have a rival. You can't have a rival. It's unacceptable. It's like that's what monopoly capitalism does. No rivals are allowed.
I'm just happy with what I have. Like, can't we just be happy? Like, I feel like if I were a meme, I'd be. And especially when you bring up like Nicaragua and the Sandinistas, which I remember from the 80s, like mm-hmm. I feel like I'd be this person just banging my head against the wall, listening to the same story over and over and over again. Am I the only person? It's like Groundhog Day.
Like, I mean, I live in Lebanon. I live in Lebanon where it literally is like the U.S. just does the same thing on repeat since like 1970. I'm not joking. The same, it funds the same players. It does the same, like, it's the same thing. It really, it just, U.S. foreign policy is just, it cycles through right? It cycles through the same thing over and over again.
And they keep us distracted with stupid nonsense while they're doing that. And well, there's always a reason. Like, manufacturing consent is extremely easy. We know that. It's not hard to do. But it almost seems like with any, especially with economic issues, that those are always under the radar because they're so not sexy and they'll distract you with whatever the issue is. But really what it comes down to is money. You know, I mean, like, it's about money and control and power, but they'll distract you. It's all a nonsense. I mean, everyone watch Rania because her new show is real.
Yeah. And we're not going to, I mean, you obviously follow what goes on with the American political sphere and the fact that the propaganda machine is literally trying to sell this the infrastructure bill was written by Exxon. So let's not pretend that what you're getting here, I mean, listen, of the $1 trillion is 100, 200 billion over how many years going to benefit and create some jobs? Yes, I'm sure it will. But what about the rest of it? What about the fact that it has already been determined that if you go through with this infrastructure bill, you are going to accelerate climate change that much more? And they're trying to sell this thing as like, we're finally passing major climate legislation. And then I got to tell you, if there is one thing I would say, Rania, and tell me if you agree or not, I think the thing that turns more people off, the average person, to politics is watching the Beltway pundits constantly circle jerking each other and talking
just
about
tribalism.
Just talking about, our president is so great and he did this. But most people are like, no, actually, he's not great. Why are you doing this? Like, can't
we're
you
battered spouses.
Slightly objective?
We're battered spouses.
You know,
Think we deserve better.
You know, you were just talking about like how Sandinistas in the 1980s, and we're saying how it's like a cycle, rinse, repeat, whatever. It really is the same with U.S. internal, like, domestic politics between Democrats and Republicans. Like, I remember, so I'm from Virginia. And I remember the governor election last week, like when the Republican won and all the like Democrats were like, oh my God. And they were blaming the left, even though like the left wasn't even running. Like, I don't know, but somehow progressives were at fault. And it was just like deja vu. Like, it's the same thing over and over and over again. But the result is the country moves to the right every single time, like policy at least moves to the right every single time. And I feel like it's been like this my entire life. Like, I remember being a kid and hearing, because I had like pretty progressive parents that were they were like Democrats, they voted Democrat, but they always hated the Democrats because they were such corporate hacks and they like were always bombing things. And so it was the same conversation then. It was the same thing. It's like Republicans, It's like a back and forth. Republicans win and then Democrats are like, oh my God, they won because we moved too far left. They triangulate further to the right. And then the only reason Democrats end up winning again is because the Republicans were so horrible and people are like fed up. And so they vote for Democrats and the Democrats are like, yes. And they don't do anything because they're still, you know, funded by the same corporate people who fund the Republicans. And so then the Democrats get voted out because they end up focusing on stupid culture war issues instead of economic issues, and they move further to the right. And it's just on and on and on to the point where now Joe Biden's infrastructure bill that we're all supposed to be so excited about apparently like further entrenches Donald Trump's tax cuts. Like, how the hell did that happen? It's unbelievable.
Right. And how is there no recourse? That's always what's so interesting for me. Cause like we're sitting here and we talk about it. So it's public knowledge that this is what has happened. It's not like this is some conspiracy theory or something weird. So it's like, we know that this happened and yet nothing, there's no possibility for recourse. That's called living in an authoritarian oligarchy, people. This is not a functioning republic.
Yeah. No, it's not a democracy.
No,
it's
not.
And one thing I will say in defense of the squad and the progressive voters, you know, if there's one thing you can take away from this infrastructure vote is that while there may be the influence and the more, you know, getting more people involved, the grassroots from having non-corporate representation, if there is a bill that Capitol Hill wants to pass, they will make sure it gets passed. Right. No matter how much of a resistance, if you will, from the side that actually gives a damn, six, seven of you are going to vote against the bill. We'll just get a dozen GOPers to join us. Mm-hmm. See how easy it works. We could spend 2, 3, 10 years talking about how much we hate each other's guts. But when we want something for our corporate donors, we're getting it, baby. And that's it. And that's how it works. And I hope.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I hope, and I think that this is sort of the evolution, because most people's political evolution took place in the summer of 2015. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of people saw Bernie and Trump, regardless of what you think of either one of them, as sort of the great awakening that hasn't happened and has been needing to happen.
Yeah.
And for so many people, they have no idea how the sausage is made. But over the course of 5 years, I'd like to think a lot of them are starting to figure out how the game is played. And a lot of these tricks that they've been able to employ for so very long, it's not working like it used to. They're not being yeah. as easily fooled. And I wonder from your perspective of how that's going to translate going forward.
I would like to think that, but at the end of the day, the problem is, like, we have a problem in America with media literacy, like a real problem, because we're not taught media literacy. We're not taught how to understand, like, how to interpret what we read in the media. We don't really understand what the agenda is or where it's coming from. I mean, 90% of what people like read, watch, and listen to is funded by like six corporations, and people don't know that. And so people also, they don't believe what they're reading and seeing and hearing because they've been lied to so much. But then because there's such a lack of media literacy, they don't know what is real anymore. Like, it's actually really concerning. This is why the right ends up gaining, I feel like, from the system, from the situation that we're in, especially because it feels like, and I don't mean to sound like such a pessimist or Debbie Downer, but, you know, with the collapse of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign in 2020, once the pandemic started, it really feels like at that point, the left sort of collapsed.
That's what I always say.
Yeah. And like, ever since then, it's like, everybody's just kind of, I mean, look what the left is, this, at least, okay, I don't want to, you know, generalize or blanket the whole left, but I just to make my point, I guess I kind of have to, but look, it's what's become of the left since then is it's become this like weird gossipy place where people just yell at each other online. Mm-hmm. And then like people's media outlets attack each other. Like, you know, and everybody's like egos getting stroked one way or another. And it's like on the ground, that's not translating into anything. But you know who's really organized, like very well organized, is the right.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very concerning, like, especially now with the way like the right, I mean, everybody thought, oh, the Democrats won. The only reason the Democrats won the presidency is because of the pandemic. Like, there's a good chance Donald Trump would have had a second term.
Absolutely.
Right. And like, and so Rania, it's just
Rania, yeah. What are you talking about? The election was stolen from me. I totally won the election. Believe me when I tell you,
It's really concerning. That was like too good. That was too good of an impression, but it's really concerning that so many tens of millions of people across the country really believe that, because everybody's just siloed off into their ideological, like, corporate echo chamber.
But the country
is, then we are like people like us are like on, you know, we have our independent outlets and we try really hard to like reach audiences. But then you have these like tech oligarchs that are building these algorithms that are literally suppressing independent media.
That's the biggest issue.
And so everybody's literally being pushed. Either you're in the Fox News box, either you're in the CNN box, either you're in the MSNBC box. And that's it. That's where the majority of the country is at. And it's so polarized. And it's really dangerous, because at the end of the day, it's like all sides have just turned into a bunch of conspiracy nuts listening to their version of reality, like on YouTube or on TV. And it's like,
we just like hear our own thing. We just like our own choir. But I'll tell you, it's funny. Like I can hear somebody talk and get an idea of what they watch, right? Like whose talking points are you spewing, and what are you saying? And it's all like, for me, and I don't watch mainstream media. I haven't in a really long time.
Well, Ron, you're a Russian asset. Last I checked, I mean, that's
not anymore. Bad. No, I was, but not anymore.
Although
I guess you kind of always are. Like, if you were once, you kind of always.
Well, you could always get called back into the fold, in the secret sleeper cell.
Or if you just do what we ask.
So let me ask you something. Do you ever want to not live where you have restricted power? Do you ever want to move back to someplace where you have more like comforts and stuff like that?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, look, living in a place where the air is not as clean and like there's always chaos isn't the most comfortable environment to live in. And also, like, once the internet stops, if the internet stops working here for functioning well, I definitely can't be here because I can't do my job. But there's something about wanting to just like be here. You know, my family is Lebanese. My family's from Lebanon. And I've been here for the past 5 years now. And it's just like, I become really attached to it. And I think it's an interesting place to be like in the region. And I'm going to try and say what I'm going to say without sounding like I'm cheerleading for people on sanctions lists. But basically, I think there's something really interesting happening in the region where you have resistance to imperialism across the region that is quite united in a really significant and I think historic way. And that's why this region's being attacked the way it is. And what I mean by that is you have like Palestinian resistance, obviously, in Gaza, mostly. You have Lebanese resistance in Lebanon. You have like Syria, which is allied with all these groups. You have resistance groups in Iraq that are like really making it impossible for the Americans to function there, which is quite hilarious. After the US overthrew the Iraqi government and still didn't get what they wanted, and they kind of want to do it again. It's actually like really funny and ironic. But and then you have Iran, which despite being strangled for like decades and the ongoing strangulation of Iran with like the maximum pressure campaign that Trump instituted, is still managed to build this like sort of self-sufficient economy where Iranians aren't like starving despite the US attempt to actually starve them. And I think this is really interesting to witness and to kind of be at the forefront of. And also I think it's important for me to like be a voice here against this, the lies, like the lies that you hear out of Lebanon. Just a few weeks ago, there was a group that is backed by the US and Saudi Arabia, a like Christian extremist militia in Lebanon that was one of the most vicious militias during the Lebanese civil war that like massacred hundreds of Palestinians. They're called the Lebanese Forces. They tried to start a civil war in this country a few weeks ago. And I was one of the only English speaking voices that was like, no, like I'm pushing against the narrative in the US by all the idiot correspondents here who were like, this was Hezbollah's fault when like a US backed Christian militia opened fire on peaceful protesters who happened to be affiliated with Hezbollah and were killed, like six people were killed. And the US media was blaming Hezbollah. Like it was insane. And so I just feel like, you know, I feel like I need to be here to like be able to speak against that because I'm here and I see what happens. And it's not
you have to bear witness. Yeah. Yes. You have to bear witness. But what's also cool from what you're talking about, like I've always taught my kids a lot based on things that they understand. So like I use Hunger Games references or whatever. And I'm like, you're in District 13. And I always explain to them when they're like places like Haiti or places that are just the poorest, Yemen and places like that, that's mm-hmm. District 12, right? Like yeah. That's just District 12 and that's we're really fortunate. It's hard, but I mean like the resistance is what you're trying to get to. Like that's what we have to get to at some point more universally. Like that's what we're working on.
Do you think we're heading for a mass extinction of some form?
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's not me who thinks that. I mean, scientists say it. Like they're like, yeah. we're in like an extinction era
Ron
right
now.
Not
a geologist.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to take out my maps and show you my calculations. But no, that's what scientists say. They say we're like in an extinction period where like all these species are just like disappearing because of human activity, which is really unfortunate. I mean, I don't think humans are going to go extinct or anything like that.
Eventually. We're killing ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know one way or another, I suppose, but I don't think at least in our lifetimes, but I do think that we're headed towards a lot of horrible climate catastrophes that are totally preventable, but we just like live in a system that refuses to do anything about it because it's just too profitable.
We're going to be fighting over fresh water.
Oh, that's already happening. Right. I already told you.
Here locally. Yeah, like that's, yes. I mean, like it's going to hit close to home. And then people will notice.
Good thing. We'll talk about off the air. Guy that I met at the event yesterday dealing with that water treatment stuff. Ooh. But it's true. You know, we're heading to a point now where, you know, not only is the water not safe, but you're not going to be able to go into a restaurant and get free water. That ain't happening anymore.
Well, they've stopped that in California years ago.
See, yeah. I would like to think Lebanon is at the forefront. Like, you know, okay, let me say this. I was joking now, but I actually mean that. I think Lebanon, people like to think of it as this backwards poor country, but I actually think it's really a lens into the future for a lot of parts of the world. And what I mean by that is, Lebanon had the reason Lebanon's economy collapsed is because it was a Ponzi scheme economy. But what people don't realize is that most capitalist economies are Ponzi scheme economies.
Right.
It's just if you're the US, you can keep printing money. But all of that money doesn't really exist. But the point is to say that, like, I'm watching this economic system break down and how it impacts, like, the, you know, how the domino effect I was telling you about. And it's this super neoliberal, like, libertarian dog eat dog, everything's privatized kind of country because of the economic system that was imposed on Lebanon after the Civil War. And this is the result of it, is what you were saying. For Lebanon, in Lebanon, since I've been here, and then when I used to visit when I was a kid, you couldn't go anywhere and get free water. It was always bottled water because the water was never, there's no state system in place. It's such a laissez-faire system where everything's privatized. There's not even really state water that is drinkable or even you can, like, wash yourself with. The buildings in Lebanon and the homes, you have to have water delivered. The water I shower with is delivered every week by a truck. It's like the most ridiculous system, but because it's like there's no state infrastructure, that's how it is. It's same with the generator system. There's no state electricity. So every building or every neighborhood has a generator. And every week or every few days, a fuel truck comes and delivers fuel to you. So you don't plug in to any sort of municipal network. Everything is every man for himself. And I really feel like this is the future. What I see in Lebanon is the future that we're headed towards if stuff doesn't change. This is like the ecological catastrophic mess that exists in Lebanon. Like, don't think that this isn't going to be your backyard one day, because it really is like that whole socialism or barbarism argument. I really genuinely believe in that. And Lebanon is what happens when you go down the war, like the road of like capitalistic barbarism.
I think the one thing that we really miss with Bernie is the fact that, as much as people didn't want to admit it, he was just way too entrenched in the DC bubble and was really not willing to just completely blow the lid on the whole thing and just say, look, this whole system is screwed up. I've been here for a generation. And I can tell you, even though I have friends on Capitol Hill, that they're all corrupt, that they're all in it for themselves, that they, you know, I may not be, but I really am the Trojan horse. There isn't really anybody like me. Everybody else is basically
a unicorn, not a Trojan horse.
Well, you know,
at this point, you know, I think you're absolutely right. And at this point, I feel like it's so urgent. Like, there isn't time. There isn't time for the next presidential election. There isn't time to cultivate the next Bernie Sanders to try to change the Democratic Party.
Bernie should have been out there right now. He should have been out there right now today saying two things. One, this bill is trash. And two, we agreed to the Build Back Better bill first. But he's not going to do that because of this whole pending fear of Trump coming, or in my opinion,
he's still going to win. Yeah. That's the thing they don't realize.
It might be DeSantis.
I think, well, it's either Trump or DeSantis. I mean, it's going to be one or the other.
We think there's a chance. Because this
President Nikki Haley. Like, you never know.
No, I don't see it.
I don't know. DeSantis is definite. People don't realize it. And because we're in Florida, we see it regularly. He is a much more appealing version of Trump.
Yeah.
He's not disgusting. He doesn't do all the gross stuff that turns people off. He's also served in the military. He's smart. He's attractive. Like, you know, I'm just saying, like, it's scarier.
We're going to put,
as
our conversation ends, we're doing our Focus on Florida segment, which we do. It's already been reported in Politico that the Democratic money bundlers are not putting any money.
The Democratic governor's organization won't put any money here.
So that already shows you how far ahead he must be. And there is a congressional candidate, lovely lady, who's running in the Tampa Bay area, who even came on and said, I'm up in Tallahassee, and I can tell you right now, DeSantis is not losing next year. So you can get this illusion out of your head.
And then he'll run for president in 2024. 100%.
So I actually think DeSantis is that. There is sort of that Nikki Haley wing, and then there's the Trump wing. And I think he blends those two together.
And you know what? Like, it's like, at the end of the day, for the people who are in charge, it doesn't matter. It's like people like us it matters.
Like, and it doesn't even matter to me because they're all bad. Like, so it doesn't matter to us, but from the other end, it doesn't matter to us because they're all corporate donored. So it doesn't, who's doing what? I mean, the social issues are definitely much more extreme on the right. You know, you're not fighting for, your right to choose. I wasn't worried about, like, under Biden, I'm not necessarily worried about the DACA kids, like, on a daily basis. Like, there's certain things in that regard whose personal people's lives were made better. And that is what I cling to, that I did vote for Joe. I didn't want to. Yeah. I'm not proud of it. But I still would argue that there are a lot of people whose lives were materially made better that aren't living in fear every day of being deported.
Right.
Don't worry. I mean, listen, the Democrats.
I'm just, you know, that is learning. A material difference. I had nothing else. Look, I was going like this. I needed something. And so that
well,
was
being
my,
in the Middle East, Trump would have been a for sure. There would have been a war with Iran. I mean, I think there still will be a war with Iran because there's going to be a Republican president in 2024. I'm like convinced if this Democrats haven't changed, they're not going to change. Like, we're screwed. We're going to get another Republican president.
So then the question really becomes, because I do not see Biden running again. He is not capable of running a general election campaign across the country in his current condition.
Nope.
They can use the COVID excuse all they want. The one thing you know about the GOP, they will literally put their lives on the line to win.
They'll rally.
That is the difference. Yeah. And so let's say, because all signs point to it's going to be a bloodbath a year from now. And so if that's the case, and they are looking at a circumstance where Biden ultimately says in, let's say, December 2022, I'm not going to run again. And so if you're going to have a primary, is there somebody who is on the non-corporate left who will step up? I don't see Bernie doing it again, but is there somebody who is willing to at least put themselves out there? Because if it's Pete or if it's Kamala, it is going
to
be
won't be allowed to. This is the thing, is they will not be allowed to, because at this point, the reason Bernie Sanders could work is he built a base, right? He had that 2016 moment. He built that base, and that base got even bigger for 2020. But, you know, unfortunately, Bernie kind of folded and it didn't work out, right? But at the same time, we forget that the U.S. government, Bernie Sanders might not be some radical socialist. He calls himself a socialist, but, like, I mean, in the context of, like, Europe, he's just, like, a pretty typical, like, center-left guy. I mean, I still like his policies and stuff. They'd be huge for America and very important. My point is, the U.S. literally overthrows, does coups, backs fascists to make sure people with Bernie Sanders politics don't come to power in Latin America. Do you really think they were going to let him be the Democratic Party nominee? I'm not saying like some crazy thing like they'd assassinate him, but they essentially made it impossible for him to win. Like they rigged it against him. Like they made it, they have a rigged system that even if he had gotten the delegates he needed, they said openly, we'll make sure the super delegates choose differently if you don't like who wins.
They did it in 1968 to McGovern against Humphrey. So it's not like the precedent is not there. So then I guess because I know you got to run in a few minutes. So I guess the last question would be, you know, we had Andrew Yang on the podcast last week. I know a lot of people are looking for another path. They're looking for something else. If there is a way to potentially build a third party movement in the United States, I think it starts with a person who has credibility, who has name recognition, can cast a wide net. What are your thoughts on, you know, just the third party movement in general, whether it be the Forward Party? I think as long as they don't take corporate money, look, Andrew was on here on record saying we are not taking corporate special interest money. As long as he keeps his word on that, I think it's at least worth seeing how far he could take it.
I mean, I don't know. Andrew Yang, I'm really unhappy with some of his policies. I appreciate the corporate thing, but he has this kind of like he has some centrist views that I don't like and some kind of like libertarian views that I don't like. I'm not a huge fan. But as far as third parties go, like I would love for there to be a third party that's viable. I just think the U.S. system is built so that a third party can never win the presidency. So I feel like we focus a little too much sometimes on like the issue of like electoralism nationally when we don't have, and I'm not an expert on this. Like there's people who can speak way better on this. I'm not claiming to know the
answer. You're not an election lawyer, Rania.
I'm not an election lawyer, but also I'm not an organizer. I know there's a lot of people who organize around these issues and could speak to it way better than I could. And I don't want to like claim to have the answers because I don't. But it seems to me that on the left, what we're missing is organizing on the local level.
Yes.
Or like you can't elect a president. You can't elect even senators, if you don't even have people in place at the local level. And I think you can do all of it. I just also think electoralism isn't the answer to everything. Like, a lot of these people need to be pushed. And that takes another kind of organizing. Like, we need robust, independent, leftist movements that are built around things like labor, that are built around things working class people can like relate to, and that are able to push for the things that we need. And historically in this country, in America, like, things weren't changed because we elected a socialist president, though that would be great. Things were changed because there was a huge socialist and communist movement in the country throughout the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s that grew, that was actually controlled, I think, like a third of the unions. Makes until they wonder, were all purged from it, McCarthyism.
It does make you wonder why the Cold War even took place.
The Cold War was like a huge aspect of the Cold War was destroying the left, not just in the Third World, but inside the West, destroying the left all across Europe, destroying the left all across America. And that's why we're still picking up the pieces of that. And we don't even know our own history in the US. We don't even know our own history and the destruction of the left. In fact, I need to have an episode on that. But the point is, I don't know what the answer is, but I feel like, you know, we're not going to win a president on the left in 2022 or in 2024. Like, it's not going to happen. And I feel like we need to be focusing. I'm glad that you guys are talking about third parties. We need to be focusing outside of the Democratic Party for sure. But we also need to focus on like movement building, what that means, and the tactics you use to put pressure, right? The tactics you use to actually pressure the ruling class. And that's a bigger, broader conversation.
I think that's something we could definitely do that the next time you come on. But we believe that a non-corporate movement through labor is how this is going to get done.
But I did want to say, this is a good segue. You were talking about we don't know our history. And I would like to give a plug because Thursday night, we are doing a Veterans Day show and we will be having Oliver Stone on. If anybody knows about history and crushing of the left, it's Oliver Stone. So,
Don't forget Danny.
And Danny Scherzin's coming on. And let me tell you, and I love Danny because he narrated his book so nicely for me. I feel like I get closer with people when I listen to them read their stories. But do you know who Danny Scherzin is? Do you know Danny?
I don't.
He's Army major, but he's a very anti-war advocate. And he was a professor.
He served multiple tours,
but he was a teacher at West Point, taught history at West Point. And he actually made a book of his lessons. Of his lesson plans. And it's kind of, to me, and Oliver Stone and he are friends. And it was kind of reminiscent of that. And Danny's book is called The Untold History of the United States. This is the problem with audiobooks.
We gotta Google Oliver Stone's thing.
Danny did, it's like 24 hours of audiobook. And so he and I got very close in that time.
That's really intimate to listen to somebody read.
They're coming on Thursday, and I'm very excited about having veterans on Veterans Day.
Building this network, and you see so much of it, Rania. You see what went on over the past several months. The left is so bad at coalescing.
Oh,
it really is. And we really need to check our egos at the door.
We cry and take our toys and go home.
That's what happened.
Bernie lost, and we lost all the progressive kind of groups, at least in Florida, like that. Basically they were Bernie groups. And when there was no more Bernie, that was it. Everyone just took.
This also speaks to the problem of like having things built around a person and their personality is that when that person disappears, it crumbles. Like, you need to have something more than that. You need to have a better foundation that outlasts a person. I mean, that's why in Cuba, despite the Castros being out of office, like, Cuba's still standing pretty strong because there's a certain movement at the foundation that like keeps people, you know, with understanding revolutionary socialism. It's not going to happen if all we ever do is build up around personalities, whether it's Bernie Sanders or AOC or, you know, whoever the next popular leftist is. Like, we have to go beyond that.
I agree 1,000%. And I'll leave you with this thought. We are in Broward County, which is the fourth bluest by population county in the United States. So we have not made quorum in over 4 years. So wow, that should tell you all you need to know. But
our party is, there's nothing.
But when you are, when the head of the Florida Democratic Party is really Debbie Wasserman Schultz, you get what you deserve. So with that said, guys, Rania Kalik, Breakthrough News.
And Dispatches. Dispatches. Yeah.
Check it out. We really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much, Rania.
It was
enjoy
a pleasure.
Enjoy your power. Enjoy your power.
Oh, I will. Bye, guys.
Stay safe, Rania.
Bye.
So needless to say,
love her.
Another great conversation.
Love Rania.
Really, I think we have christened the new property very well.
Yeah, my hair is just awry. Guys, you don't understand my shower situation right now. It's not ideal. My bathroom situation is not ideal. I moved, and this is the thing. So everyone knows, okay, I'm a cannabis partaker, and I can appreciate other cannabis partakers. What I cannot appreciate are cigarette smokers that smoke in their bathroom and don't open windows and then sell that house to somebody
else. Is that like a person who's like trying to hide that they're smoking if they're smoking in their bathroom? Or do they just want to, you know,
I don't know. All I know is for anybody, if you smoke cigarettes inside, you will not be able to, like, the next people are going to suffer because I cannot get, like, if you guys are weed smokers, we need to just smoke out in my bathroom, I think, for days on end and shut the door. I don't know what to do. The cigarette smoke is killing me.
We're not done yet. So we got one more segment, as you guys know, on Sundays.
And of course, anybody not in Florida might not find this interesting. Well, we used to do it on Mondays, but now we're a Sunday show. We have Focus on Florida. So these are just some of the things that are going on right now here in Florida. We sort of touched on the DeSantis story, but basically the organization of governors, the Democratic coalition, the fundraising people, the fundraising arm of the Democratic
with gubernatorial
right
races.
Of the Democratic Party, yes, has decided that they are not investing any money into Florida's race in 22. So unfortunately for people like Nikki Fried, Charlie Crist, and I don't know, did Annette Tadeo officially
declared? Okay. She is a candidate.
So those three people are going to be fighting unusually uphill battle against a Republican machine and not have any assistance. And I'm not really taking up a collection for any of them because they're all fairly centrist. And honestly, I don't think have a snowball's chance in hell.
As we pause for our, what we call an update or no, a plug for our channel. Good friend, Mallory McLaren has officially become
a
It's the Lulu sticker.
Well, it's the Lulu sticker, but also it's because she knows I moved really close to her. Mallory lives right up here. Mallory, I'm like off of Cleary and Knob Hill now.
So there you go.
Now I'm in Bridgewater,
people
Mallory.
People are going to stick you. It's going to stalk you, so be careful with that.
Like they would. Do you know how many people live in this square mile here?
So, everybody, patreon.com/generationalchange.
I don't have the Lulu sticker to hold up right now. It's in a box.
Do you want to hold up Lulu?
No, she's so comfortable. I'm not messing with her.
I'm not going to bother Lulu right now. But for as little as $5 a month, you can become a patron. It would be a huge help to our show, not because we're trying to pay ourselves, but because we're trying to do mutual aid service to the community.
And it costs money to promote and get stories out there, which what we're ultimately trying to do is build a coalition and transform politics into service.
I think we're doing a decent job.
We are. But to do that, it does require certain funds. Like we have our the StreamYard account and we have the... what are the other thing? Canva and all these things that we use to do this show are just and it's not a lot. Like we're a pretty low maintenance vibe here, but we will be having a very cool studio as soon as we can get my garage up and running.
Yeah, a noted former
we're gonna be like Wayne and Garth in a garage.
Big time candidate has already mentioned, hey, when are you guys gonna have a studio so I can come and join you in the studio? What are we gonna be the?
And we also will be soon having another congressional representative on our show, which is very exciting.
That'll be the following week.
Okay, but anyway, get into Focus on Florida.
So as we have been sounding the alarm for some time, as you guys know, I do believe that Ron DeSantis, especially after what just happened on Tuesday, is going to be the GOP nominee for president in 24. Now, could something happen over the next 12 months? Yeah.
And it could also be Trump. It could also be Trump. Like, I wouldn't completely rule that out. But I just think that it's going to be, DeSantis is definitely in that.
The GOP is just such a smarter party in terms of how they execute from the ground up. And look, most people who either serve in the military or support the military are in the GOP. And so a lot of what the GOP does is run like the military. That's why they're so efficient at what they do. And even if you don't like their tactics, and some of their tactics are downright nefarious, that's putting it nicely, they get the job done because they literally operate like a military, you know, unit would operate. And so Ron DeSantis, former military man, is clearly in a very good place.
Yeah.
Because the fact that we are a year out and the Democratic Board of Governors are already saying we're not touching this race, that's a bad, bad sign.
And I think it says two things, though. I think, yeah, it says that DeSantis looks good. It also says that they don't believe that Democrats have anybody that could even put up a fight.
That's also something.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's completely one-sided. But speaking of sides, we also in Florida have what I am now calling the war of the masks.
George Nix's challenge to ban on Florida school mask mandates. Look,
they just going back and forth. This is actually taking up time and resources of people is fighting back and forth about the mask mandate.
Hysteria. Hysteria sells. If people are afraid, they spend money and they get hyper-focused, and then
that's true.
It becomes distorted vision. So by continuing to harp on this issue and make it a political issue, like I've always said, a lot of people hate DeSantis, but as we've always said, the one thing DeSantis hasn't done is he hasn't bitten off more than he can chew.
Not yet.
That doesn't mean he won't. But that's always
he definitely toes the line. But I do think that so.
But as he has learned from Trump, you have to have a strong base.
So
you have to have a riled up base.
I will say this: the current status of the mask ban, because if you have got to be paying attention, it's like watching a tennis match. As of right now, the ban on the school mask mandate is not there. That's not going to go through. So right. The school mask mandates are still standing as of right now. That is the current status. By next Sunday, that could change. To be continued in either what I call Florida COVID corner or war of the masks.
Well, apparently Florida has like the lowest COVID rate now. So
interesting.
Look, I mean,
well, we're also so transient. I mean, that's a big part of it.
And the fact that DeSantis's wife has breast cancer. God, it's just like every single possible thing from a
political standpoint. You couldn't write it better for him.
His script has just been,
yeah.
And you know what? In many ways, he is a Frankenstein. He is the Frankenstein of the Frankenstein because Trump created DeSantis.
Yeah, but DeSantis, you know what though? I don't dislike DeSantis at the same level that I would dislike Trump.
And that is exactly what most independent voters are going to say.
Yeah.
I can't deal with
I don't
Trump,
hate DeSantis.
But I can deal with DeSantis and that's going to be the difference. And the truth of the matter is, a lot of the MAGA supporters, that's their choice. Their choice, if they can't have
and
Trump,
he appeals,
is DeSantis.
And he also appeals to more moderate center people.
That's
he
true.
Does. And he's not offensive. I do not hate, and again, but I always and have to preface this with, we come from Rick Scott for 8 years.
That's true. One
so
of the absolute worst representatives
right,
in the country.
Right. Like the worst. So we had him as governor for 8 years. We're very skewed here in terms of perception. So correct. That let me preface that. It's not like I'm coming off like, you know, some great governor. Is there a good governor out there? Are there
apparently
any good governors?
Apparently Phil Murphy, New Jersey.
So let's talk about the Gators.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a Gator, but.
I know, because you went to Rutgers. Did you go to Rutgers?
I went there. I did. So.
So I am not usually, and I am not a Florida State school person. So
however,
I have no feelings one way or the other about the Gators. But apparently the University of Florida had issued a mandate that there were three professors at their school that were being asked to be expert witnesses in the case against the voting restriction in Florida. Okay. And the University of Florida said that they couldn't get paid to do that. And apparently they have reversed that decision and they're allowing the professors to be paid witnesses against the state, against the voting restrictions. I'm losing my mind, people. The new law on voting restrictions.
Right.
What's it called?
I don't remember.
It's voting. The new Florida law regarding voting. And so the University of Florida is stepping up and they're allowing the professors to testify against this. And that is a good thing. It is good in the sense of yay, free speech. And it is also good to know that the university is not being the bitch of the state.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. I appreciate when you take a stand. And so way to go, Gators.
And so with that said, and we are obviously big proponents of you executing your constitutional right to vote, we live in a country where both sides do everything in their power to make sure that their side wins. And that involves voter manipulation by almost any means necessary. It just so happens that corporate media is way more heavily skewed towards the Democratic perspective than it is the Republican.
And when we say Democratic perspective, we mean centrist, neo-lib, milquetoast, corporate Democrat.
Correct. We're not talking about non-corporate
representation. And to that end, where are we with the District 20 race? Because
so one of the things that you guys probably noticed, and this is our conclusion for the day, a lot of focus when it came to the off-year election was the New Jersey and Virginia gubernatorial races.
And the mayor of Buffalo.
There was very little
media
was paying attention to that. And of course, we all know who was getting behind Mayor Brown. And the fact that the Democratic Party in the Buffalo area and throughout the state wasn't actually backing India.
We can't with them.
So there is something to be said. But here in District 20, many of you may or may not know, Alcee Hastings was a representative in this district for exactly 30 years, 15 congressional terms. He passed away of pancreatic cancer, and there has been a special election that just took place. And the candidate, there were two non-corporate candidates running, but the candidate that we supported, who we believe would win because of her infrastructure that she built over the course of running two previous times, financially speaking and name recognition, is Sheila Sherfalus McCormick.
You still don't say it as good as I do. Sheila Sherfalus McCormick.
Okay, so Jen says it better.
I just like her name. It rolls off the tongue. Yeah, it's butter.
Well, it sounds like it should be on Capitol Hill.
You know what? I'm going to start calling. You know what? She's SCM.
SCM.
She's SCM.
SCM Rush. Good search engine. So Sheila is currently in the nail biter of nail biters.
And
you would think that corporate media would at least be shining some type of a light on this race.
They don't want anybody to know about this.
So Sheila currently leads longtime Broward County Commissioner Dale Holness by 5 votes. And the final recount, and it's not even a recount because the recount is done and Sheila won the recount.
But yet,
there are still overseas ballots that need to come in. Now, most of them, my understanding, are
Republican,
are military. If they're military, odds are they will be for the GOP. That doesn't mean that there aren't some outstanding votes that are out there that could potentially affect the election. When is this going to be? Five votes. Next Friday is when the final vote tally will take place. I even said to Sheila, you're not sleeping for the next 7 days.
No.
So
no.
This is...
But guys, it would be so good if Sheila wins.
I cannot emphasize enough that this is a big deal. This is the shot in the arm that not only South Florida would need, but the country.
Yeah, we would actually have a progressive congressperson in Florida. Guys, we don't have any. So this would be huge. And the fact that her district butts up right to ours and she's a local person to us is huge.
Yes.
Huge.
And this also speaks to, if you ever want to see this lady run for Congress again,
would also be a big deal to have Sheila
winning. Would be a game
massive.
Changer. It would.
Yeah.
Now, I also want to preface this with, there is a lot that can happen. There is a lot that can happen because the general election will take place in January. Now, this is a plus 35 district.
Yeah.
So this is a foregone conclusion.
It's a Democrat.
So she'll win by 50 points. That's not the point. There will be a primary in August.
Yes, because this was a special election. And so we can't let up on it, even if she wins.
There are great odds that, especially because of how close this race was, they're going to go for round 2.
Oh, yeah. Or somebody else will come out because it's like vultures. This thing is like these people down here, as soon as Alcee died, they were vultures on a carcass, except Sheila. Sheila was the only candidate that has run twice before against Alcee, was willing to challenge him while he was still sitting in that seat.
And when she ran the second time, she got 35% of the vote.
Which is amazing.
So it's not like she wasn't.
She has worked for this seat and she stands for the things that we stand for. She really does. Sheila supports Medicare for all. She supports universal basic income. Sheila supports
a living wage.
Yeah, I mean unions she stands for what we stand for. She's a fighter.
She's not over woke either.
No. And she's just, She would be an amazingly good congressperson. She even looks like a congressperson.
She does. She's got the disposition.
I don't look like a congressperson. She looks like a congressperson.
Perhaps. Well, then she'll improve your fashion, I suppose.
Sheila is very put together. Sheila always looks put together. Sheila showed up at the labor rally last week in the t-shirt and her nice slacks, and she still looked all put together in the t-shirt for the rally. Like, I'm like this sweaty, disgusting mess with my hair on top of my head, and Sheila's like perfect.
I will also say, and you know, Debbie's troll writer for the paper, which shall not be named, was there at the recount event. It just goes to show
that guy.
Yeah, that person who we don't have to name. I'm telling
you, our newspaper is such a rag here.
Really, really just not so good people involved at the local level in politics. And that's really where we need to be involved. So as Rania said,
she's so smart.
If you're not currently involved with your local, even if it's your DEC, get involved. I'm telling
and
you.
And I also think, and I've said it before, and I will attest to this, that going to commission meetings is like watching paint dry. I am not a fan. It really sucks. However, the more that you do that, I do think it's important for people to know who their commissioners are. That's really where you can have not just the most inroads, really, but that's where you get the most benefit. Those are the things that affect you the most. Like, for example, for people who live in Plantation, you know this, the blue garbage bags. It's the bane of everybody's existence in Plantation. Why do we have the blue garbage bags? I don't know. Why can't they go away? They discuss it every year. They can't get rid of the blue garbage bags.
Why did the building collapse in Surfside? Because there were residents complaining nonstop about saltwater erosion on the old buildings forever.
And how that's being shifted around, by the way, is now that's being shifted into a conversation about giving freedom creating a overseer commission to make sure that the condo associations don't have a choice as to whether or not to spend the money to fix things. Right. Here's the problem with that. They don't have that kind of money. Nobody has that kind of money. That's the problem. So you can tell them that they have to repair it, but they can't bleed a rock. And somebody who lives in a one-bedroom condo that maybe they bought for a few hundred grand 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that person cannot come up with $300,000 assessment that would be required to fix their building.
And just so
the money isn't there. It's not going to happen that way.
It's not just corporate media. It is big tech, because big tech has the ability to inform each and every person about what's really going on and what needs to happen. And instead, they control the algorithm, which is why, even though, look, believe it or not, we actually did decent today in terms of viewership. But if the algorithm was fair, we would have had several hundred people watching live when we were speaking to Julian Assange's significant other. And that
she was lovely.
She was. And that, unfortunately, is a byproduct of the system, which is why we focus so much on building these coalitions. So that's what we need to do. And so with that said,
what do we have coming up? And by the way, Sam, are you going to come help us set up a studio here? I got an entire single car garage. We're going to put in a split AC unit. We're going to set it up we have like a whole blank canvas to create a real studio. So, but I have no idea what I'm doing, Sam. Yeah. So if you want to be a part of that, I would appreciate it.
We need your fabulous insight, my friend. So on Thursday,
what do we have? Oh yes. Thursday, big day.
So as you know, Thursday is Veterans Day. And we will be speaking with Director Oliver Stone.
But we are still Wednesdays normally. But this week, because it's Veterans Day, correct, we are going to be on Thursday.
Mm-hmm. So we are looking forward to that. I may have a new job in a couple of days.
That's very exciting. And thanks to me, kind of.
Yeah, thanks to you. So we'll see what happens.
Thanks to me selling and buying a house.
Yeah. So I guess I owe you.
Yeah. He's like Kramer.
Yeah, I know.
He's like Kramer in my house. He just comes in like, anyway. So Veterans Day, very exciting. Oliver Stone, Danny Scherzin, will be, I don't even know I'm going to be able, you're going to have to help, because I'm going to be like not able to necessarily have a coherent conversation with Oliver Stone. Like, that's a pretty big deal to me.
Well,
he's responsible for really a very big part of reshaping my historical education.
The best I could do if he's on the show is try to talk like Jack Kennedy as best I can.
I don't know that that's
I'm going to walk on it. I'm going to walk on it.
All right,
there's no Oz. There's no Oz.
All right, but see, then you sound like, I got to think of who I thought you sounded like.
Mayor Quimby.
No. So that's on Thursday. Next Sunday, guys, we have Brian Klass. And I really didn't know anything about him, but then I went and watched the TED Talk and it was really, really good. And so now I have downloaded the book, but it is not going to be available to everybody until right when it we get these pre-books, which is one of the coolest things about this. I'm not going to say job, but this thing we're doing is that people send us books before this thing of ours is that we get to read advanced copies of books. But the problem with that is for me, who is now lazy and likes to do audiobooks, that doesn't come out earlier than the day it's released. So you have the book. I don't get to start the book until I believe, I want to say it comes on the 9th. I might be, yeah, the 9th. I got to start listening on the 9th. But Brian Klass, and we're going to be talking about?
We're going to be talking about the, I guess what you would call the manipulation of of absolute power is probably the way that I would describe it.
It's very interesting. Guys, check out his TED Talk. It's yeah. Brian Klass, K-L-A-A-S. And that's who we're going to be talking to. I didn't know who he was, and I was his TED Talk. There's a couple of them. We're really good. Also, we have a very busy day next Sunday. We yes, have we other interviews. We're going on other shows.
Yes, we are.
We will be... Oh, we're going on with Fire Breathing Rob.
Yes, we are.
We're going on with Fire Breathing Rob. Fire Breathing Rob is a kid that went to Lynn. He's from Lynn University from the, right?
Isn't that's, it? Yes. But that's only the appetizer.
What's right. And then we're going on with the John Brown leftists.
And that'll be interesting.
Which will be really fun. I like that. Which is on the Reset Race Network, guys. On the Reset Race channel, you could see the John Brown leftists. We will be live with them on Sunday afternoon.
Let's keep building that coalition.
Next week.
Friends. Great to see everybody. And we will see you on Thursday.
Bye, y'all. Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.